Mrs. Cooper was a very important person to our presbytery. She helped our presbytery in forming the child protection plans for all of the contiguous 48 states here that were in the Pacific Coast Presbytery that had churches. So Nevada, Idaho, Washington, California, Arizona. She helped us form them, and she also had contacts into Canada that helped us to also do those provinces before they went into their own synod. And so she is behind the wording. She's behind all the experiences that she has. She was a prosecutor for close to 20 years against exactly these type of crimes. And so that she brings a lot of experience and wisdom to this. As a reminder too, the session especially wants to seek your forgiveness for being so long in getting this to us here in September. We adopted the plan back in March 2022, and we're just now getting to the annual training. So this is long overdue, but we're so happy to have Mrs. Cooper. We're gonna be recording this, so you'll be able to access it via recording afterwards. And that's also how those who are not able to attend today, that's how we plan on having them trained as well. And so there will be attendance taken by Elder Shipman, so we know everyone that is here, and everyone that's not will be making the recording available. Because of the importance of the recording, we tested it once and it worked. So if there's any issues with the recording, just let me know. That way I can have Mrs. Cooper pause for a moment in that regard, okay? So let me go ahead and begin this time with prayer, and then I'm gonna hand it over to Mrs. Cooper. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for this opportunity to place this training before your body as we consider the way that we may protect your little ones. We do pray that you will do this great work. We thank you for the experience and the expertise you've given Mrs. Cooper and the many wicked men that you have used her to put behind bars. We pray that you will continue to bless her profession and her calling that you have on her life, and we ask that you will bless us with that which you have called her unto. Bless this time in this training. We do ask, Father, that you will do all these things for Christ's sake. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Right. Mrs. Cooper, is all yours.
Okay, thanks. Y'all, thank you so much for letting me come here today and chat with you about one of, I think, one of the most important topics that comes up in my profession, and that is the protection of minors from sexual and physical abuse. As Pastor Chris noted, I can't give this presentation to you without talking about very serious topics that even for adults can be difficult to hear. So use your best judgment, and if any time you think, you know, I need to get up and escort my kids out, that's fine. I'm going to do my best to make this PG-13 PG. It just is, it's sensitive topics. But it's so important that you're here, and especially for the teenagers, thank you for being here and listening today, because I have a little section at the end about how important it is for you to stand up and defend your peers, and that it's not just about adults protecting adults, it's also about children protecting each other. I, as Pastor Chris noted, I was a prosecutor for a very long time. I was a prosecutor up in Payson, Arizona, and there are only three attorneys up there to handle all of the crime happening in northern Gila County, so I got a lot of experience in a very short amount of time, and they designated me as their sex crimes prosecutor. So very quickly, I started handling these types of cases, sexual abuse of minors and adults. And I did a lot of work there. I wrote the mandatory reporter protocols for the for all of Gila County. And I did trainings to our law enforcement officers and our other partners in the community about how to deal with the mandatory reporting law here in Arizona. And so that's kind of similar to what training you are going to get today. I'm going to go very deep into the mandatory reporting law and how it applies to each of you. And then we're going to talk about some scenarios and some, you know, worst case scenarios and best practices. And then we're going to talk at the end about prevention. Why is this such a serious topic? Because the statistics say that about 1 in 5 children will experience some form of sexual abuse before their 18th birthday. So you think about that. Think about the neighbors on your street. If 1 in 5 of those children experiences some form of abuse, or the children in your church, or the children in your school, everywhere you look, there is going to be a child who potentially is going to suffer some sort of abuse. And so it's so important to be aware of what is going on out there so that we can prevent it from happening and protect our children. Okay, we're going to dive right into the statutes. Now, you should know that when I get into the statutes, I just try to tell you all of the terrible, you know, things that might happen and how broad the statute is, but you should not be expected to memorize anything that I'm telling you today with respect to the statute. What I want you to do is have a red flag that goes off in your mind when you have something come up that you're like, oh, I think a child is maybe being abused, that something bad could be happening here, some harm might be going on here. I'm going to go and tell the right person that I am noticing something, even though I don't know for sure if it matches the statute or not. And, you know, Pastor Chris then will say, oh, yeah, this is a mandatory reporter issue, we're going to have to report it, or he's going to say, let me call Lacey because I have no idea, right? So that's what's going to happen. So don't expect to memorize everything, but I do want you to know sort of the breadth and scope of the statute so that you have some flags that go off in your mind. Here's the basics of the statute. If you are a mandatory reporter, and we'll talk in a minute about who that is, and you come to reasonably believe that a child has been abused in the past or is currently being abused, or is an infant that's not being properly cared for, you must immediately report what you know to law enforcement. So most states across the country have some sort of law like this, because it was going too long where an individual would learn that a child was abused and then they would think, well, I'm just going to deal with this myself, and I'm not going to tell anybody. Or this child is a family member, or it's a patient, or somebody that I'm caring for, and I'm just going to deal with myself, or I don't want the family to get in trouble, right? And states across the country said, no, it is too important for the protection of minors to allow people to make these decisions themselves. We're just going to make it a law that you have to report to law enforcement when you reasonably believe that abuse has happened. There are a couple of exceptions to the law that I'll tell you about in a minute. So who is a mandatory reporter? It's not just this list, but I'll go over this list, but think about medical professionals. A doctor is a mandatory reporter. A counselor, a mental health professional, is a mandatory reporter. A police officer is a mandatory reporter, but also school personnel, any member of the clergy, school volunteers, church volunteers if you help with children. There's actually an attorney general opinion that says any person who has responsibility for the care or treatment of a child is going to include people like school volunteers or, you know, church volunteers, because if you're working with children on Sunday morning, then you have responsibility for the care of that child, at least during that hour and a half or 2 hour, you know, period of time. So you're going to be a mandatory reporter. We're going to expect you and actually legally require you to tell law enforcement if you notice something is going on with a child. Also, a parent of the child, which is really interesting. Your parents sitting in the room right now, you maybe never thought of yourself as a mandatory reporter for what harm actually happens to your own child. But it is true. If your child is abused, if you learn that they have suffered some sort of physical abuse, not by you, but somebody outside of your home, you actually have a legal obligation to report that to law enforcement. Who are clergy? This is sort of an interesting question, but the gist of it is that your church defines who clergy are. So whatever, you know, this presbytery says is clergy, that is going to be the definition of clergy. Now, as I just said, it's not just clergy that have this responsibility. It's also going to be anybody who has the care of a child, and so it's going to be, you know, far beyond just who your clergy are. It's also going to be anybody who is the supervisor of like a church member, or the next level up supervisor from that. So it's also people within the chain of command who are going to be required to make a report. What kinds of things do you have to report? Well, first we'll start with child physical abuse. And obviously I have a long list here of the kinds of things that would qualify as child physical abuse. And all this comes from the statute. I'm not just giving you examples. These are statutory examples. But it's not just, is there some sort of physical injury? But we're talking about like even bruising or any sort of bleeding. Obviously a broken bone, burns, any physical condition that imperils the health or welfare of a child, but that's pretty broad, right? It's going to encompass a lot of different types of physical injury. And then, of course, child sexual abuse. Now, there's some obvious things that would be covered under this as well. Any touching of the genitals, anus, or female breast, except in the appropriate caretaking function, for example, bathing and diapering. And you should know that it's actually built into your child protection plan what you all should be doing to care for a child when we're talking about assisting them with going to the bathroom. Or a special needs child or adult, what are you supposed to be doing to interact with them? What would be an appropriate caretaking function? What would be the appropriate bathing and diapering? So that's all already been contemplated and is set forth in the child protection plan so that you can go back and look at it and make sure that you understand what it is that would qualify as the, you know, exception to the rule about what you can be doing. But it's apart from that, we're talking about any sort of touching, directly or indirectly, clothed or unclothed, using your body or an object. So that's a lot of different things that you can be using to touch and it clothed or unclothed. Are you with me? Okay. That's the type of thing that comes up the most often when we're talking about sexual abuse. However, you know, if you are offering sex to a child, if there is an indecent exposure, right? Somebody is, a man is exposing himself to a child. Voyeurism is something that comes up more often than I would have thought, but that is a pretty common thing. So also surreptitious photographing or videotaping of a minor. These are the types of things that would qualify as a child sexual abuse. Any exposure to pornography or any taking of photos of a child that would constitute, you know, a child pornography. Any evidence of incest. The voyeurism might come up, obviously, with a surreptitious videotaping, but it also could come up with, let's say, a stepbrother who's sort of like got a peeping Tom thing going on, right? So there are lots of different ways, different examples about how this could happen. It also covers mental and emotional abuse. So not just physical, not just sexual, but also mental and emotional abuse. That could be anything that the child is feeling some serious emotional damage. The child is displaying severe anxiety. The child is displaying depression, withdrawal, untoward aggressive behavior. Unreasonable confinement of a child would be included in here, which I consider to be sort of like an extreme discipline measure. Somebody who, a parent who locks a child in a bedroom for 48 hours without feeding because of, because they think that's the appropriate discipline. That's something that you're going to have to report to law enforcement. Any other extreme discipline. Now, I always get this question. I'm not talking about just like normal spanking, right, of what we would believe to be appropriate punishment for a child, appropriate discipline for a child. I'm talking about the kind of discipline that would result in physical injury to a child, bruising, that sort of thing. It also encompasses child neglect or endangerment. So a child endangerment almost always comes up in the context of like a DUI, parent is driving a vehicle and is intoxicated, and there's a minor in the back seat, and so they've obviously put that child in danger. Even if nothing ever happens to the child, just the mere fact that they're driving under those circumstances has endangered the child. Or it could be a drug use in the home or something like that as well. But neglect is a little more interesting. So neglect is going to be any time that a child is not being provided with the bare essentials. They're not having appropriate supervision. They're not getting food. They're not getting clean clothing, right? They're living in sort of a hoarder house where there's, you know, pets, you know, are allowed to go to the restroom inside of the house, and there's feces everywhere, and their bed sheets aren't clean, and their clothes aren't clean, that sort of situation. If you come across a child who seems to be living in those sort of conditions, you need to be reporting that to law enforcement, because a child doesn't deserve to live in those conditions. The other issue on the slide is an infant that's not being nourished properly by a mother, which, you know, you can imagine a postpartum depression situation where the infant is not nursing properly, something like that, where the infant's not getting proper nourishment, then and the parent isn't doing anything about it, then that would be reportable. When do you report? The statute says that as soon as you develop a reasonable belief that a child has been abused or neglected, you must report immediately. What is reasonable belief? I don't know. It's not actually put in the statute what is reasonable belief. I can tell you sort of what our standards are in other criminal contexts. So the little, you know, treatise on how, you know, standards of proof works. Beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what you have to prove at a criminal trial if you want to prove that somebody has guilty of a crime. Beyond a reasonable doubt is, let's say, 90% on a scale of 0 to 100. Clear and convincing evidence is another standard of proof that we sometimes have to prove to a judge. That's something like 65%. Preponderance of an evidence, that's what we have to prove when we're in a civil trial, and you have to prove more likely than not. So it's like just over, it's 50% plus one. Is preponderance of the evidence. Probable cause, that's what a law enforcement officer has to have to get into your house without a warrant or to get a warrant. And that would be maybe 30%. Reasonable belief is something less than that. It's like more than a scintilla of evidence. You know, it's more than like zero, but it's slightly less than probable cause. So it's enough for you to say, okay, yeah, I have some facts. And then when I put those facts together with the statute that Lacey's talking about, I am now, you know, have a belief that this child has been abused, and that belief is reasonable. I'm not just suspicious that something has gone wrong here, but it's based on reason. I have some facts to support it. And then what does immediately mean? Well, that's not in the statute either. So I would just say that one caveat is that you're never going to get in trouble if you call your attorney before you call law enforcement. So if you need to call and consult beforehand, that, you know, that's going to be okay. If a child is in imminent danger and you don't call law enforcement or 911 like right as soon as you develop a reasonable belief, you are much more likely to be in jeopardy under this statute than if a child is not currently in danger and you wait 24 hours, 48 hours to make a call. I would never suggest that somebody waits 72 hours. So that sort of gives you an idea. We're talking about a 24, 48-hour window to get the call into law enforcement, with the exception of you got to do it more urgently if there's an imminent threat to harm to that child or some other child. This often comes up with in the context of someone who says, well, I'm going to report to law enforcement, but first I want to do a complete investigation of my own. You know, I want to do all of my own witness interviews. I want to make sure that I have all of the evidence before I call law enforcement. And the answer is the statute doesn't give an option for that. You can't just do a complete investigation because that's what you feel like you want to do before you call law enforcement. However, you're not triggered to call law enforcement until there is a reasonable belief that a crime was committed. And that The reasonable belief sometimes does not develop until after you've gathered some facts and interviewed some witnesses. So there's a little bit of a balancing act here. There has to be enough evidence to actually get to the point where I don't just have a suspicion, I actually have a reasonable belief, and it's a reasonable belief that a crime has been committed, some abuse has been committed that actually falls within the mandatory reporter statute, right? And once I get there, I'm gonna call law enforcement and I'm not gonna continue doing an investigation until, you know, I decide that, you know, now I've completed my investigation, I've wrapped it in a bow, and now I'm ready to turn it over to law enforcement. So it's somewhere in between that. It's definitely not triggered until you have a reasonable belief. But once you have a reasonable belief, you're not supposed to continue on with your investigation. Now, the not continue on with your investigation is not in the statute. That's best practice. And I want to talk about that a little bit more when I get to my best practices statute. My slide. Thanks, by the way, to slide guys in the back who are just like sticking with me, and I'm not even telling you it's time to keep moving. That's great. Who are you going to report to? You're going to report to police. Now, the statute does allow you to also report to the Department of Child Safety, but that's only if you if the abuser is the parent. But you always can report to police. That works every time. And if you report to police and the abuser is the parent, police will then call the Department of Child Safety, and they will do that for you. If you happen to have a suspicion of abuse against a child who lives on the reservation, you can also report to the tribal agency. But again, any law enforcement agency is going to cover you every time. So I just tell people, don't try to figure out which person is the right person to report to. Just call 911, or just call your 911 if it's an emergency, or call, you know, the non-emergency line of your local police department, and they'll figure out which jurisdiction did this happen in. Oh, is it actually Phoenix PD that needs to get this notification? Okay, we'll hand that off to Phoenix PD. They'll figure that out for you, and they'll notify the right people. When you report to police, you will often get pushback from lots of people. You're gonna get pushback from the victim. The minor is not gonna be interested in having this report made to law enforcement sometimes. The parent of that victim, maybe the school official, maybe the reporting party who told, you know, you that they suspect that something's going on, and they told you that in confidence, and they didn't want you to pass that information on to law enforcement. Here's the thing. The mandatory reporter statute is sort of a sword and a shield in that way, because you have an obligation to report. So even though you have these people who are going to be mad at you, you can say, I didn't have a choice. I had a statutory obligation to make the report, and I'm sorry, and we could talk through how that feels for you, what the consequences are, and we can, you know, shepherd you through that. But the law required me to make the report, so I made the report. Here are a few exceptions to the rule. If the injury appears to have been caused by accident, so consider a situation where some boys are playing flag football out on the grassy field, and gets a little out of hand, and one of the boys goes down and he skins his knee and it's bloody. Well, I told you bleeding and, you know, physical injury are both going to be qualify as physical abuse. However, this is obviously an accidental injury that just happened during the course of a sporting event, right? So that's not gonna be something that you're gonna have to report to law enforcement. If there is consensual sexual contact between minors who are 14, 15, 16, or 17 years old, then you do not have to report to law enforcement. Now, it has to be consensual, and it has to be those ages. It doesn't count if it's 13, and it doesn't count if it's 18. Now, you still might want to report to law enforcement. These are just exceptions to the mandatory nature of the statute, but you don't have to. If you have an adult who is disclosing some abuse that happened to that adult when they were a child, okay, obviously the physical injury or the sexual abuse or whatever was something that happened while they were a minor. However, now they are an adult and they are able to make that report themselves. We're worried about the mandatory reporter statute because we do not believe that children have the ability to make these decisions themselves until they turn 18, that they need protection from others until, up until they turn 18. But once they turn 18, we've kind of passed that torch on to that adult to make the decision whether to report or not. Now, brings me back to the question I had, whether you want to report anyway. Let me give you an example. A 20-year-old female says, when I was in high school, I had a teacher who was inappropriate with me. Well, that she was a student at this high school 3 years ago, and there are lots of other high school students who are still in that teacher's class. Is it important for you to report what's going on so that the other children who are still at the high school are protected? Yes, of course. I'm going to tell you to make that report every single time. You don't have to make the report if another mandatory reporter has already made the report. Now, you want to be sure that the mandatory reporter has already made the report. So with church staff, I often say, you know, you're going to all sit down in the room together and make the call together. Or there's going to be some sort of email confirmation. Yes, I did call law enforcement today and I told them what was going on, so that you can say, okay, great, somebody else has already handled it. It's not good enough if you have a parent who says, oh no, don't worry about the abuse that happened to my child. I already made a report. You're not going to want to count on that because you can't trust that the parent has actually done what's required, and then you're not going to get the cover that's needed. A confidential communication to clergy does not have to be reported, but my next slide is about confidential communication to clergy, so we'll do that one next. I'm going to tell you about the priest penitent privilege for your education, but then I'm going to tell you that your church doesn't actually practice this in the real world. So in the statute, there is a privilege that applies to communications with clergy that a clergyman is not required to report to law enforcement something that they learned from a minor let's say from a perpetrator in a confession situation. Now, it's going to have to be like a one-on-one where there's a confession happening. There's going to have to be circumstances that demonstrate that this is the type of communication that's expected to be confidential. We're not talking about you're out at a barbecue with your pastor and you say, hey, I want to tell you something that I, did last week, right? It's going to have to be in the course of that, clergy's role at the church. And it has to be in accordance with the tenets of the church. Okay, well, now I can tell you that's not in accordance with the tenets of your church to keep those things secret. It's built right into the child protection plan that you all believe that, or at least your church leadership believes that that sin is, especially just the sin of sexual abuse, is supposed to be brought to light and made public, and there should be a public repentance, not just in the church itself, but also to the community. And so that is not, the priest penitent privilege is not going to apply in your congregation. But I wanted to point it out because sometimes people hear this and they're like, oh, is that something that we have here? And your church, it's not something that you have. But this is just a picture of a Catholic confessional. So that's the most standard form of the priest penitent privilege. An individual parishioner will go to confession, and they will sit in one side of the booth, and the priest will sit in the other side of the booth, and they can say whatever they want to in that booth, and it all stays confidential, even when they're reporting horrible things that were done to children. Okay, next slide. What happens if you don't report? If you're a mandatory reporter and you're supposed to report immediately, what can the consequences be? They're actually quite severe. You can be prosecuted for a crime. It's a class one misdemeanor to not report most types of abuse. And for the more serious ones, it's actually a felony offense to not make the report to law enforcement immediately. If you report, on the other hand, you get criminal immunity. You get a free pass. You then get to, you just have your card that says, I reported, I called law enforcement. I don't know what they did with the information that I gave them, but I did my part, so now I can never be prosecuted for not reporting. You could also be sued if you don't report. But if you do report, you get civil immunity. You get protection. You can't be sued anymore. So there's a carrot and a stick, right? You absolutely have severe consequences if you don't report, and if you do report, you've got a lot of grace. So reporting is definitely the way to go if, you know, as soon as you have the reasonable belief. And the other very severe consequence is not to you personally, but to all the other children who may be victimized because you didn't take the time to report what was going on. Just a statistic, the average pedophile has molested over 300 children in his or her lifetime. And 32% of sex offenders who were assessed as a high risk to reoffend did so within 15 years. So if somebody, especially when we're talking about child sexual abuse, if somebody has a propensity for that, if they have a tendency toward that, if they've done it one time, they're gonna do it again. So it's your job to make sure that they don't do it again by reporting. Okay, let's talk about some best practices. Number one, I would say, is especially when you're talking about child sexual abuse, if a child is making a report, that your first duty is to believe the child. I've been doing this a very long time. I can think of one instance where it was a little unclear whether the child was fabricating because they were being coached by a parent in a divorce proceeding. But even in that very unusual circumstance, it seemed like there was something untoward that was happening in the home, and there was just a little bit of coaching on one parent's part or the other. For the most part, in the vast majority of cases, a child does not come up with a story like that without there being some truth to it. And the most important thing that we can do is to believe them immediately and to make sure that they know that they're believed. Because you could be the very first person that this child has ever disclosed to, and if you don't give them the appearance that they are going to be believed, they may never repeat their story ever again and just carry that burden with them for the rest of their lives. Or they could, in their next recounting of what happened, they could lie about it and hide it because they are afraid that they're going to not be received well. And then they, not only then does the perpetrator not get prosecuted, other victims get victimized, but then that child does not get the healing that they need because they do not believe that others will believe their story. Don't conduct an investigation. Okay, so you have to conduct an investigation to form a reasonable belief. Once you get there, there are reasons why you wouldn't want to do an additional investigation. Now, again, this is not built in the statute. This is just from my many years of training with respect to law enforcement and things like that. When a law enforcement officer conducts an interview of a minor victim, they almost always take them to a secure facility where they have a special room that is nice and comfortable, and there's couches and there's cushions, and they have video recording devices so that they can record the statement that the child is making so it can be used in future prosecution. And they have what's called a forensic interviewer there, which is somebody who has been specially trained. Not, they have usually some counseling background, but they also have this like law enforcement piece that they're able to engage with that minor on a particular level to help that minor to tell their story, even though they're talking about something that they don't fully understand. It's a very controlled environment, and it's also done with very skilled investigators. So if you conducted a full interview with a minor before they had an opportunity to go and do their forensic interview, you might elicit some testimony that doesn't come out later. You might unwittingly suggest some answers to the minor that should not have been suggested, helping them to find their words, right? So you can, again, not intentionally, but you can unintentionally sabotage the future interview that law enforcement is going to do that's going to be recorded that can be used later. That's probably the most important interview not to conduct if you can avoid it. Now, there may be circumstances where you really can't avoid it. There's some suspicion that something happened. The only person who can tell you about it is the minor. You're going to have to conduct an interview with the minor of some point, of some sort, just to figure out sort of what happened. And in that situation, I would suggest that once you get to a point in the interview with the minor where you're like, okay, now I understand, or, you know, I'm at the point where I have a reasonable belief that something happened, maybe then you terminate the interview. You just kind of ask some basic questions to get the information that brings you to a reasonable belief, and then you can say, thanks so much for telling me, you know, I believe you, thanks for disclosing, and then you can go and report to law enforcement. But it's also best practice not to conduct an investigation if not necessary when we're talking about other witnesses as well. Sort of the same thing. Law enforcement, when they're doing interviews of three individuals who saw the exact same event, they often are going to separate those three people and do the interview separately. Whereas we might say, hey, two people who saw the event together, why don't you tell me what happened? And they're playing off each other, and they're hearing each other's story, and they're building their story together. And that's fine. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to be influenced by each other, not necessarily, although that's almost certainly going to happen to some degree. However, later it will come out that they were together, and the jury might believe that their stories were influenced. And so law enforcement is almost certainly going to separate people. Law enforcement might think that witness number one's interview needs to be taken before two and three because they know that some information that witness number one has might be helpful to understanding the interview of two and three. So they might do interviews in a particular order. Law enforcement might have evidence, physical evidence, a document, for instance, that they want to use when they conduct an interview because they want to be able to show the witness, hey, here's a photo of the car wreck. You are suggesting that the car was blue. Here's a photo of the car wreck. Does this refresh your memory about what happened? Oh, I did say blue, but I can see now that it was probably just black and I just saw it really quickly, right? So they're gonna have some tools with them to conduct that interview. That's what they're trained to do. Now, not all law enforcement is fantastic at this, but this is what they're supposed to do. This is what they're trained to do, especially once they get to the point where they're detective and they're supposed to be doing these interviews. And so we do wanna give them the opportunity to conduct those interviews. I would say that's even more true when you're talking about a witness who is also a minor. They might want to conduct those interviews in the same way that they do with the forensic interviewer. I've had a forensic interview used not for the victim, but for the victim's brother, who is quite young, right? So the brother has not been victimized. However, the forensic interview was able to conduct these interviews with young folk in a controlled setting, and so we say, hey, we're going to bring in some more witnesses who are minors to do in this particular way. And again, if you've already conducted interviews of everybody, it may disrupt the future law enforcement investigation. So that's why we say this is not really a blanket rule, don't conduct an investigation. However, think about how are we going to make sure that we don't ruin a future law enforcement investigation by conducting interviews on the front end, except to the extent necessary to get to the level of reasonable suspicion. In your child protection plan, it addresses this specifically. It says, once you have reasonable suspicion and you report to law enforcement, then you're not supposed to continue on with interviews unless you cannot get the information otherwise, because you all have interviews and an investigation that you do as a church body that needs to be done for church discipline. And so you have agreed as part of your child protection plan that if possible, there'll be deference to law enforcement investigation. And so if there, for instance, is a police report of a witness interview that you can obtain that then gives you the information that you need that the witness said, then maybe that will be sufficient for you not to conduct a second interview with that witness, or maybe it won't. You know, maybe then you have to do more, but there's a sort of a pause built into the child protection plan. Hey, once I get to the level of reasonable suspicion, I'm now triggered to report to law enforcement. If I can pause now on my investigation and let some law enforcement do their part and get information from them, get some information from the minor victim's parent, and put some pieces together without doing further investigation. I'll do that first and then do whatever further investigation is needed for the church discipline process. Best practice is to call me, unless it's an obvious case. If you absolutely know that a child has been injured, you don't have to call me, call law enforcement. If you know, you know. If there's any gray area, then you can call me. And then you're going to call the police. Then you're going to call the child's parent, unless the parent is the abuser or the police tell you not to. And you're going to make sure that you write notes. If you are the reporting party, if you are receiving the report, you know, Pastor Chris is, if you are a witness, it's so important for you to write down what you remember contemporaneously with the events that happen, so that a year from now, 2 years from now, when this case finally goes to court and you're asked to actually sit on a witness stand and testify about what happened, you will be able to look at your notes in advance and say, I totally forgot that that's how that happened, but now I remember because I wrote it down at the time. Because our memories, they fade over time. If you are interviewed by law enforcement and they write a report, you can ask them for a copy of that, and then you can tell them, you know what? You wrote that down wrong, and I need you to correct your police report because that's not what happened. I want to make sure that what's in your police report is accurate. Next slide. I've already sort of gone over, like, you do want to be careful with your church or employee discipline to make sure that you're not trampling on the law enforcement investigation. And like I said, it's a very tenuous, you know, balance here. This is not built into the statute. This is just best practice to make sure that you're not interfering with a law enforcement investigation to the best that you can. And again, it's in the child protection plan. If you happen to have a victim and abuser at the same church, then you want to make sure that they have minimal contact, or a alleged perpetrator. Let's say you haven't quite figured it out yet. You're going to want to make sure that there's separation there. You're going to make sure that there's a good counseling strategy in place for the victim and shepherding for the alleged perpetrator. You're going to want to have a safety plan. This is more likely for the larger churches where they're still going to have an alleged perpetrator show up on campus. I think that's less likely here. And then you want to put your protocols in writing, which you have. It's the child protection plan, and do training, which you are doing. So well done, ticking off those best practices. And this is also built into the child protection plan, the reporting of grooming. Most sexual perpetrators will begin grooming a child long before anything actually happens. They will work to develop a one-on-one relationship with a child. Let's say an adult and a child. They will work to develop a confidential relationship with that child. They will work to isolate that child. They will even work to gain the trust of the parent to have individual contact with that child. And they will teach the child that what happens between them should stay a secret. All of that has to happen long before any misconduct happens. And so it's also built into your child protection plan that you need to be reporting not just abuse. I mean, sorry, to your church leadership. You should not just be bringing actual abuse to the attention of your church leadership, but also any grooming activity that you are noticing, any inappropriate flirting that you are noticing, any other inappropriate behavior. If something just strikes you the wrong way, somebody just doesn't feel right to you, go ahead and bring that to the attention of church leadership, because one of the best things that you can do to make sure that you don't have a wolf in your congregation is to be the kind of congregation that is very protective of your sheep. Here's a couple of examples of folks that did it the wrong way, and maybe I might have one example of some folks that did it the right way. The Southern Baptist Convention has been in under great scrutiny lately because they learned of some allegations of abuse that happened within the SBC, and they chose not to report it. And most of the time, the reason that they didn't report is that they were fearful that the church itself was going to be sued. However, the very worst thing you can do is to put the fear of a lawsuit over the protection of a child. And in fact, you're basically inviting yourself to a lawsuit if you do it that way, rather than take ownership and deal with it out of the gate, which is, you're not going to be able to read this, but the next slide is an email from Jamie Rasmussen at Scottsdale Bible Church when they learned of a former pastor who had been there many years prior who there was allegations of abuse. They said, hey, this pastor's not working here anymore, and we probably don't even need to tell you about it, but we're going to tell you that he was here in the past, and there are now some girls who have come forward in alleged abuse, and we just want to put it all on the table and shine light on it. So if there are any victims in our congregation, that, you know, here's a hotline that you can call. We want you to come forward and let us know what happened. That is the best path forward. It's just shine a light on everything. Isn't that what Scripture teaches us anyway? This is actually the individual who against whom allegations were made. This next slide, he was going on mission trips or church retreats or choir trips with students and engaging in misconduct while he was there. And the reason that I want to bring this to your attention is that these are trips that are away from his church campus. However, it still needed to be reported. And it happened in the 1980s and 1990s, but it's really old, but it still was best for Scottsdale Bible to come forward and say, hey, we want everybody to know that this happened and get it exposed. So importantly, it does not matter whether we're talking about an allegation of something that happened in your church congregation, by one of your church members, or on your church campus. That doesn't matter. If you learn of abuse that has happened to a friend who was abused in Kansas when they went home, to Christmas for the holidays, and it has nothing to do with Scottsdale or Paradise Valley, you still should report it. And it also does not matter if you think maybe the statute of limitations has passed and that somebody can't be prosecuted anymore. It's still important to report. And the next slide is another example of some misconduct that was happening at Hamilton High School here in Chandler. And what was kind of important here is that the allegations were secondhand kind of hearsay. And one student said, hey, some bad stuff is happening, in the gym. And the alleged victim was asked, and the alleged victim said, oh, no, that never happened to me. And yet Chandler police actually reported some school administrators to Maricopa, or referred charges to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, and asked these school administrators to be charged, even though they didn't have personal knowledge about what happened, and they had a victim who was denying that it had happened. They just had these sort of rumors of hazing and things that were going on. Now, the Maricopa County Attorney's Office didn't charge because it didn't actually rise to the level of being able to charge it, but gives you an idea of, at least the Chandler Police Department is very aggressive on these situations where you have some knowledge and you don't report it. Here's another example of a Mesa High School coach who was engaged in inappropriate behavior. And I mentioned that there is an exception to the law when you're talking about 16 and 17 year olds, but it doesn't apply to a 20 year old coach. He is, even though the girls were 16 and 17, the coach was 20 years old. And so the exception doesn't apply when you're talking about an 18 year old, 19 year old, 20 year old. It only applies when we're talking about those who are still minors who are between 14 and 17. Here's another example of a Young Life camp that learned of some campers who grabbed a female camper's breast, and they just asked him to apologize. Well, that's not going to do it. You can't just ask him to apologize. You're going to have to report that abuse happened, even though we're talking about minor-on-minor contact now. It was unwanted contact on that female, and it was a mandatory report. The next slide is sort of an example to help you think through the statute. So if you had a six-year-old boy who arrived at your Sunday school class on Sunday, and he had a black eye, would that be enough for you to say, oh, I need to call law enforcement? No is the answer, right? Because you don't know how he got the black eye. You don't know if he fell. Could have been an accident, right? But what if he has bruises on his arm that look like a fingerprint to you? Exactly. That's maybe a gray area. Not sure exactly how he got those fingerprints. He could have grabbed his own arm really hard, right? So this is an example of that alone is not going to rise to a reasonable belief that would trigger your report under the mandatory reporting statute. You're going to have to do some investigation to figure out what is going on before you know whether you need to make a report or not, before you know whether abuse has happened or not. What if the child arrives at Sunday school and they have belt marks on their back? I would say now we're just going to report. And that's one you probably don't even have to call Lacey about, because this is the type of extreme discipline that would, even if the parent says, hey, you know, I was spanking him and it just got, you know, the belt went up a little bit and I didn't mean to do it. For your sake, I think you should just go ahead and report it, because you need the criminal and civil liability immunity. You need to be protected from having consequences if you have an overly aggressive detective at the, you know, Scottsdale Police Department who says, I'm going to go after everybody who's supposed to report and they don't report, and even though this may be a tiny bit of a close call, I'm just going to go after. You don't want that headache. So if I don't even know that one's a super close call, but it's a situation where you might say, I need to think about that a little bit. I would say just go ahead and report that one. Does this help to understand a little bit of, like, what's not a report, what's a situation where I'm going to have to do some investigation before I know if it's a report or not, versus, okay, now I'm going to have to report it? Okay. Here's a situation. A 15-year-old boy is in... gets in a fight and he sprains his wrist, and he says that he got in a fight with his father. Now, first of all, we know sprained wrist, that's going to be a physical injury. So that's going to be from our earlier slide. That's going to count as a physical abuse if there is some perpetrator that caused the harm, and he's saying, yes, I got in a fight. That's how the harm happened. And he says it was his dad. Okay, yeah, that's going to be a situation where you're going to have to report. What if it is his 12-year-old brother? He and his 12-year-old brother get in a fight. He sustains a physical injury. It's not an accidental situation where they, you know, one just happens to push the other one down because they're scuffling in the hallway, but they actually, you know, are in a fist fight, and one brother ends up with a sprained wrist. The answer is, under the mandatory reporter statute, yes, you have to report that, which is a little counterintuitive for how we have been parenting children for a long time. Usually we would say, well, I'm just going to deal with that myself, right, as a parent. But the mandatory reporter statute is, in my opinion, overly broad. The same would be true if he got in a fight with one of your other high school students on campus or something like that. Like that, even though it's two minors who are involved in the fight, you still would have to report it. And this, again, is a situation where are going to have the minors themselves who do not want you to call the police. You're going to have the parents who do not want you to call the police. You're going to have the, you know, maybe your, if it was at school, you're going to have the teacher who doesn't, you're going to have all these people who say, why are you calling the police in this situation? It's so silly. We'll deal with it ourselves. And you have to say, I'm so sorry, the mandatory reporter statute requires me to make a report, and I'm just going to go ahead and do it because that's what is required. But I will tell you that when you make that report, because I've had this happen many times as well, the police department has much better things to do than to deal with this. And so this is the kind of scenario where you're going to call and you say, I just feel like I have to make a report because I think that's what's required, but I don't believe that law enforcement needs to be involved. It seems like it's being handled. And I, you know, 99 times out of 100, law enforcement's going to say, thanks for calling. You're good. We're not going to send anybody out for that. We're not going to waste our time on that. But you still would have made the report. Do you have a question? the mandatory Porter statute encompasses that conduct. It is overbroad. And remember, if you are a parent, you are a mandatory reporter. The statute's overbroad. That's a very good question. The scenario that I'm providing here, I kind of added some extra facts of, yes, it was actually a fist fight. It wasn't just like I accidentally pushed somebody down while we were playing flag football. It clearly was non-accidental. They were intentionally going at it, and one of them was injured. I think the mandatory reporter statute interferes with parental rights, and hope to, in one day, amend the legislation to curb some of these scenarios, because I don't think that they're right. And I will also tell you, from talking to school administrators, that they make these reports of, you know, scuffles by kids on the school campus all the time, and they're like, oh, it's so silly, because it's not, you know, there's nothing's going to happen with it, but they just do it anyway because they have to, and it's a real time suck. I'm going to skip this one because it's a little more intense. And then I want to talk about prevention, because it's one thing to have a child who has been abused, and then what am I going to do about it? How do I stop, you know, this from happening in the future? How do I protect this child? How do I provide counseling to this child? But what would be even better is if we could prevent this from ever happening. And I talked a little bit already about one of the things that we need to do is we need to be really on high alert for grooming behavior, for suspicious behavior, for somebody who makes us, you know, feel, if you are a minor, somebody that makes you feel uncomfortable, a parent who says, I don't really like how that adult is interacting with, not with my kid, but with one of the other kids who comes to Sunday school, one of the kids who just seems a little bit more vulnerable or a little more attention-seeking. He wants to spend a lot of time with her, and that makes me feel uncomfortable. Your child protection plan says those are the types of things that you need to notify church leadership about so that you can figure it out right away, deal with it up front. Even if it doesn't rise to the level of requiring a mandatory report, you're still going to investigate, figure out what needs to be done, and stop abuse before it happens. Another thing that you should know, and it's in the child protection protocols, is that a church is private property. Even though we think of it as a public space that anybody can come to, right, show up on a Sunday morning and walk in, it is still private property. And what that means is that you can kick somebody off church campus or prevent them from coming back to church campus. Now, you have to be the church owner, but I'm sure that you could coordinate very easily with Camelback Bible to give you authority to keep somebody from coming to the church campus who you don't want to be here. So there's not like some constitutional right for somebody to just show up on campus on a Sunday morning. That's not true. If you want to keep somebody off campus, you can, and you should, if they're somebody who you feel is going to be is a perpetrator or potentially is going to interact inappropriately with your children. You should not be having adults or teens who are helping with the care of children. You should not be having one-on-one interactions with minors. So you shouldn't, unless it's your family member. And this is, again, built into the child protection plan. You're not supposed to be having one-on-one interaction with minor. You create a culture where that's not okay, and then it's very easy to find the guy who's disobeying that particular rule, and that's the one you want to be suspicious of, right? You should never be traveling alone in a car with a minor when you're in a car, again, other than a family relationship. You should not have physical contact with a minor while you're in the car, and you should not be going on detours. So if you're in charge of making sure that minors get from the church campus to some event that's a mile away, you're not supposed to stop at the Circle K on the way because all the kids want to get a Slurpee before you take them there. You're supposed to just go straight from point A to point B, and that should be the culture of the church, and that's part of the child protection plan as well. There is only appropriate physical touch with minors that's allowed, and appropriate physical touch is kind of outlined in the child protection plan, but we're talking about high fives, a handshake, maybe a side hug, but nothing more than that. And it should only be a physical touch that that minor is okay with and open to. We as adults should never be forcing a hug on a minor because it will make us feel better, right? It should only be what the minor is comfortable with. You should also not be having, just like you shouldn't be having one-on-one interaction with a minor in a physical space, you should also not do so in a virtual space. So that means you shouldn't be having one-on-one, like, text messages with a minor. That's an easy thing to solve. You just do a group text. You know, if you are supposed to be driving a group of three minors from the church campus to the event 1 mile down the street and you need to coordinate what day or and what time and where you're going to meet, great, just put all three of them on the same text thread together so that they're all observing what you're saying to all of them and you're not having one-on-one interaction. If you're going to have social media communication with minors, same thing. It should be, you know, public. It should not be a direct message. And there, you should be mindful of whether social media communication would even be appropriate with a minor unless there was, you know, circumstances that would justify doing so. But that's not the type of place where you should be developing a deeper relationship with a minor. If you, this especially comes up in the teen context, but for adults who are shepherding teenagers, you are going to have situations where you want to have conversations with them about, for instance, their purity, right? Staying pure until marriage. Great, you can have those conversations, but the Child Protection Plan requires you to have another adult present to have that conversation. Not just you and three minors, but you're really supposed to have another adult present to have that kind of conversation. And you should never be using yourself to give examples of, you know, hey, let me tell you about my dating life, but you can talk about what Scripture says and what God expects and why it is that God has called us to purity, but you're supposed to be doing that with another adult present. Again, it comes up more in the teenage context, but if you're having conversations with a teenager, you should never give them the impression that everything they say to you is going to be held confidential, because it may be that you need to disclose what they tell you, either because you need to comply with your mandatory reporter obligations or because telling another adult or telling church leadership is the best way to care for and counsel and shepherd that child. So you should never be giving them the impression that, hey, you can tell me anything and I'll make sure it's just between us. And the last thing that I want to say is that I believe that one of the most effective tools that you can give to children to make sure that they never experience abuse themselves is to give them a voice to speak out. And the fact that you have decided to invite some of your kids here today tells me that this is the kind of church that encourages children to speak out. When I was, you know, growing up, these types of conversations were taboo in my home. Then I became a sex crime prosecutor, and I had to say all these words out loud in big groups, and now I can do it without a problem. But growing up, these conversations were taboo, and so, you know, there were definitely circumstances in my growing up where I easily could have been taken advantage of by someone because I didn't know better and because I thought that talking about it was off limits. I can think of one example in particular of I was standing in my kitchen, and my father was in the living room, and I was, I don't know, maybe 11 years old, something like that, and a prank call basically happened. A guy called and was asking me some conversation or some questions about myself that were very private, very invasive. I didn't understand it at the time. Eventually, I was able to get off the phone, and again, my father was standing 20 feet away from me. I did not tell him that I just got a weird call. I did not tell him what the guy was asking me. I just went to my room and felt, you know, embarrassed and ashamed for the next 4 years until I finally told one of my best friends. And I was so easy prey for someone, because I was a child that didn't have a voice that felt like I should speak out or could speak out when we were when it comes to this sort of difficult topic. So I think one of the most important things that we can do for children is to let them know from as early of an age as possible to using the age-appropriate language. Hey, you need to let us know if ever you feel uncomfortable, if ever anyone touches you inappropriately. It is and not just appropriate, it's essential that you bring those things to our attention so that we can handle it. There's nothing that you can say that would be off limits or taboo. You need to let us know, and we'll have those conversations. And to the teens especially in the room, you are the best defender of your own peers. You need to speak out for yourselves, but you also need to speak out for your friends and people that are on, the other kids on your school campus, the other kids on your church campus, to protect them when there's somebody who doesn't have a voice and you're somebody who's very confident and is able to speak out because that's what kind of person you are. Then you need to be watching out for others and speaking for them if you see that they're being taken advantage of. Or that the potential abuse is happening. And sometimes you might be the one person that child is willing to disclose to. It may not be an adult, it may be a friend, and then you need to take that to bring that to the attention of your parents or church leadership so that something can be done so that we can speak out and prevent child abuse from ever happening. That's my presentation. I did not leave time for questions in the middle. I just went through it. So does anybody have any questions for me? Yes. The latter, yes. Thanks for asking that. The report form is a tool that's a place for you to write down as much information as you have, but you should not make sure that you tick all the boxes before you turn it in. Just put the information that you know on there. And, write your witness statement, not just the, fill out the information that's on the form. Now, the form is designed to help you to gather some information that law enforcement will ask. Because the statute requires you to provide particular information to law enforcement. So if, for instance, you don't have on hand the address of the victim, you may not have to ask the victim that. You may be able to get that information from somewhere else. Go ahead and write it down so that when you call law enforcement, you'll have that information readily available to give them. Yes. Yes. Yep. Yeah. No. Yeah, and by the way, I'm making those numbers up. That's yeah. Okay. So there's zero evidence. There's what we would call a scintilla of evidence, which is just like a tiny shred, right? Reasonable belief is going to be above that, let's say 20%. Probable cause is going to be 30%, because that's going to justify somebody actually getting into your home, which is a castle here in, the man's castle here in the United States of America. And then preponderance of the evidence is 50%, and clear and convincing is maybe 60%. Am I going too fast? And then beyond a reasonable doubt is 90-95%, something like that. So what reasonable belief is more than a suspicion. It's more than a shred of evidence, and it has to be based on reason, which it means, it's going to be based on some actual facts. But if a child says, my father hit me, I would report that. If I wouldn't even worry about whether that you could see physical evidence of the hit. I would just report that. if a, a child has a bruise and you have no idea where it came from, then you're probably going to have to ask some questions to figure out if there's some reason for that bruise that can be traceable to somebody doing something wrong to the child that would be going to constitute abuse. Are you with me? Okay. And these are hard questions, and I, like, part of my job is sitting in my office and taking calls from churches and nonprofits to ask the hard questions, because there are lots of gray areas, and there are times when I advise churches and nonprofits, actually, this is not one that rises to the level of a mandatory report. Yeah, something bad happened, and you can, you know, you need to think about what you're going to do to help your congregation move forward, but it's not, what has been reported is not actually one of the things that's required by statute. So you can decide whether you want to report or not. This is a, what I would call a discretionary report. There's just a lot of gray area. Yes, you can also interview the suspect. If there are, answer is going to be the same for that as it is for interviewing any of the witnesses, right? If you bring in a suspect to be interviewed, you could jeopardize a future investigation, because then law enforcement doesn't get to use all the tactics that I just said, plus all their other special tactics that they use, when, especially when we're talking about a perpetrator. I don't know if you knew this, but the police is allowed to lie to people when they're doing an interview. That's totally allowed and lawful, and so they often do that as one of their tactics when they're in an interview, and people don't know, like, perpetrators often don't know that, and so the police says, you know, I actually have your fingerprints at the crime scene, and, you know, the perpetrator is like, oh, no, now I need to confess what happens, and the police officer didn't have the fingerprints at the crime scene, but they use that tool, so... That's sort of a silly example, but now you all know how to get around law enforcement interviews when you commit a crime of burglary. Just kidding. But yes, you can. There's nothing to say that you cannot. Same answer. Can, yes. Should you? Goes back to sort of, you know, not interfering with an investigation. Would I? It depends on the situation. It depends on whether I knew that, you know, a crime had been committed or not. If I knew that a crime had been committed, I probably would not. And the reason is that I would contact police, because if I was going to do an interview, I probably would want to do that with police guidance, and they might still want me to be the one who does it, but I might surreptitiously record the interview so it could be used later, you know, things like that, and I do it with their direction. We have what we call confrontation calls as another tool that law enforcement uses, especially if a minor victim is an older teen, and they're willing to place a phone call to the perpetrator to say, hey, you know, I'm really upset about what happened, and get the perpetrator to admit what happened is another, you know, there's just a lot of tools that law enforcement uses. We never want to sabotage their investigation so that the perpetrator cannot be brought to justice. So those are all considerations that you guys have to take when you're, you know, deciding what investigation is appropriate, at what point it needs to stop. Yeah.
Thank you.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, especially if we're talking about child sexual abuse. If you have a child who's reported some sexual abuse, I would never put them anywhere near the perpetrator ever again. Just protect the child. A confrontation call scenario is typically an older victim who is able to make that call without it jeopardizing their mental and emotional health. So without the physical presence and at law enforcement direction, that sort of thing. But I agree that would, if we're talking about physical abuse or neglect or something like that, perhaps I wouldn't feel as strongly. But when you're talking about sexual abuse, I agree with you. So let's say we're talking about a 19-year-old and a 17-year-old. Make it easier. It'll be an 18-year-old and a 17-year-old. They met in high school. They're still in high school, and one's an adult and one's a minor, and they're in a romantic relationship. It is okay for them to have a romantic relationship. It is not okay for there to be any sexual touching, and that would have to be reported. Do you have, yeah. At what point would I say, go, is it too weird? No, yeah, that's a good question. If there's no inappropriate physical contact, then it would not be a mandatory report for a 35-year-old man to have a romantic relationship with a 15-year-old girl. However, that's the sort of grooming, inappropriate relationship that you want to be take some action. This is it. This is your training on grooming. Yes. Yes. Oh, that's a good question. I don't normally see that. I don't normally see an adult perpetrator who uses another adult to get to a child. Normally you're seeing the adult perpetrator be the one who is the one grooming the child. What the earlier question was about, at what point are we talking, do we feel like that's an inappropriate relationship because the age difference between the minor and the adult is so great that it's really kind of awkward and icky. Not reportable, but awkward and icky. I would say if it feels awkward, you're going to tell church leadership so that you can decide if something should be done to intervene to protect that young woman. Yeah. More questions? Yeah. I am on retainer for church leadership, for you to call me if you need me. Yeah. You're going to tell church leadership. If you felt like church leadership was maybe not doing what they were supposed to do, then you would call, you could call an attorney and get legal advice, but you couldn't call me because I already represent the church. It would be a conflict of interest. Does that make sense? So if you want to call me to hang out and grab a cup of coffee, my phone number is up there. But that's for church leadership would be the ones who would be contacting me. Well, sorry, I mean that in a very legal sense, conflict of interest. My firm cannot represent church leadership and a congregant who is upset with church leadership and feels like they did something wrong. Does that make sense? So that's a very, very legal term. So no, not legal advice. You'd have to call your own attorney, yeah, or retain a separate counsel. That's an infant that is not, let's say, not latching on, not eating, and is not thriving. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah. Okay, good, very good question. So we're talking about a situation where it's obvious that a child is being abused because they're showing up every day with bruising that's weird, something like that, but you don't necessarily know the cause of the abuse. You would report, you would write in there and report to law enforcement what you do know, and then if you suspect something, you could write that down as well, but I would make sure that I wrote it in a way that was like, hey, and tell law enforcement, hey, I don't know what's going on here. I don't know the cause of the bruising, but I will tell you that there was this interesting interaction with her father last week, and so I'll just bring that to your attention, but I'm not sure that that has anything to do with the bruising. That's how I would phrase it. Correct. You do not have to find out. Yeah, you're going to put what you know. You're going to tell law enforcement what you know, but you know that could be helpful information that gives them a lead that they can go investigate if you happen to know that there was a negative interaction with her dad that upset her. Yep, you're going to call law enforcement. Then you're going to tell the minor's parents, unless the minor parent is the perpetrator, or unless law enforcement instructs you not to for some other reason. And maybe they would instruct you not to in a scenario like what you gave earlier, where there's a bruising, we don't know who the perpetrator is, we need to investigate that first. They might say, well, don't call the minor's parents and tell them yet, we want a little time, you know, if is that possible. Now, you don't have to do exactly what they say, you know, if it's not possible to withhold that information from the victim's parents, but if they've asked you to, I would say, you know, if that's possible to comply with their request, that would be good. What, could you tell me what you're reading from? Oh, I'm not familiar with that document. There was at least one thing that you said that was not accurate, so that's why I asked who gave you that information. Okay. That's not true. The 24-hour rule is not true. Do I need to repeat that? What's your name? Rihanna was reading from a document that is given out as a resource to the American Heritage Girls. Is that right? And it says that you must make a report within 24 hours. The reality is that's not what the statute says. The statute does not have a 24-hour requirement built into it. The statute just says immediately. So that's why I have that whole slide on what does immediately mean, you know. And if it's gray, call your attorney. Nobody's going to be mad at you for calling your attorney and getting legal advice before you make a report. If there's some imminent threat, call law enforcement right away. Don't even think twice about it. If there's not an imminent threat, you're going to have a little bit of grace period with law enforcement if you're, you know, figuring things out before you make the report. Yeah, I think I understand the question. So the scenario is something weird happens. You don't quite understand what it is. You don't rise to the level of a reasonable belief. You don't make a report at that point. And 6 months later, some more of the puzzle pieces become known. You can figure out what happened. And, oh, yes, now I do know that an abuse occurred. You would report at that point, at the later moment. And you would not be held accountable for not reporting when you first had some suspicion, because as we discussed, suspicion is not the legal standard required in the statute. You have to have an actual reasonable basis to believe that a report was necessary. And the let me just tell you, the mandatory reporting statute, if you thought that my slides were complicated, it's far more complicated than what I have here. The statute refers to other statutes, which refer to other statutes, which refer to definitions, and it's a whole rabbit trail to even figure out what all of them mean. So even if you looked at something on my slide and you were like, oh, intuitively, I know exactly what failure to thrive means, or intuitively, I know exactly what abuse means. You might not know what abuse means because it might be a word, which abuse is, defined in statute. And you have to go look at what is the definition of statute or of abuse according to the Arizona State Legislature. And when you go look at that, you're going to see that they refer to about four other things in other statutes. And you, oh gosh, I thought that I knew what that was. I thought I knew what abuse was, but it's not just what your common sense tells you or what you intuit. It's what the law actually requires. And you only get to the point of a reasonable basis to believe that an abuse has occurred if you have a reasonable basis to believe that one of those underlying statutes has actually been violated and that all of the elements of that statute have been met, which is just the legal term for each of the little prongs that somebody did this thing under these circumstances. All of those little prongs have to be met before you get to the point of, okay, now I have a reasonable basis to believe that abuse has occurred as defined by the Arizona statute, and therefore it's triggered. So the original scenario of I just have a suspicion that something bad happened is not going to be enough. You're gonna, 6 months later, when you say, now I know abuse did occur, then you're going to report. If you're suspicious that abuse has occurred, you are going to be safe if you report it. That there's nothing wrong with reporting. But you're not required to report at that point, just because you have a suspicion that something bad happened. And I think you started with, is it, you know, better safe than sorry? The answer is, I can't tell you. It's going to depend on the specific circumstances. There are situations, which I've come across many times, where it was better for a church not to report, but instead to love a family through a terrible situation and help them to get the counseling that they need and help them to have restoration in their relationships with each other and with the Lord, and that was the better course rather than making a report, where a report was not mandatory, it was discretionary, but it still was, it was bad circumstances, right? It still was something bad happened, but it wasn't a mandatory report based on the statute. And we all agreed, you know what, there's probably a better path forward here, not reporting, unless as you get along the way, you learn one of these other facts that would trigger a need to report, like there's going to be another victim or something like that, right? So it's going to be case specific. The better safe than sorry is not going to, you know, it's not going to work every time, or not going to be the right decision every time. Yeah. The parent of the minor victim is a mandatory reporter all by him or herself. So that parent should be making a report as soon as they have reasonable belief. A 100%. You still would probably want to tell church leadership, because this comes back to the part of the child protection plan that says if you are aware of some grooming behavior or inappropriate contact or anything like that that was happening inside of the church, you really should take that to bring that to the attention of church leadership so that they can do what needs to be done to keep the congregation safe. And then once they church leadership knows about what happened, if they also come to have a reasonable belief that the statute has been triggered, then they would have their own independent obligation to report, unless they knew without 100% certainty that a report had previously been made by the parent. Does that answer your question? Are you asking, Chris, about the child protection plan's requirements for one-on-one interactions with a non-family member who is a minor? Yeah, I do know what you mean. I'd have to look at the language of it to see whether that's included or not. This brings, like, parental rights are important. So I don't think anybody wanted to create a scenario where a parent couldn't say, hey, you know, this is somebody that I trust to take my kid to the soccer game or something like that. So I don't think that the intention of the plan is to reach to that situation, but I would say that bad behavior sometimes happens in familial relationships as well. So for parents, you still want to be very thoughtful of who it is that you trust your children to be with. Was there a question from the back? No. Okay. Good. If you don't have any more, oh, we do have a question. Yeah, if you are a parents of one child, or maybe you'll only have one child left in the home, and you're hiring a babysitter, and it's an adult who's going to be staying alone with your child, I would just say that you need to be so very careful who it is that you choose to have that role in your child's life. And that I would say that whether we're talking about an adult or another minor, let's say you're hiring a teenager to be your babysitter for the night, because abuse happens amongst children as well, not just adults on children. And the other thing I would say is think back to my part of the presentation where I talked about giving your child a voice. It's so important to make sure that your child is reporting to you everything awkward that, you know, might have happened in their interaction with that babysitter, so the child is protected. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's a scary world out there is the answer, and you want to be so careful who you trust with your children alone. And thank you to the folks who are foster parents, because that's a unique and special gift to our community. And I love that our churches especially have been stepping up and helping in the foster community. So that's wonderful. Okay, well, we're out of questions, which is great because I'm out of time. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Yeah, of course. Okay, great.
Let us pray. Father in heaven, we do praise you for this time together as a church family. We do pray that you will protect our children. They are yours. And so we pray that you will utilize this plan and this church family to protect one another. We do, as we had so many things brought to our mind, we do pray, Father, that you will bless our foster families. Thank you for what they do. Bless the parents giving them wisdom and all of their parental rights and philosophies. And we ask, Father, that you will bless the church leaders, that you will give them wisdom in leading with a limp. And we ask, Father, that you will bless Mrs. Cooper. Thank you for her vocation that you called her to and her great help she has been to this body. And so now we do pray that you will bless us in this day.